Settlement to Superpower, Episode 12. What goes around comes around. Hello everybody and welcome back. I'm Abraham Ash, and this is From Settlement to Superpower. So, of course, to begin, I'd like to apologize for the length of time which has elapsed between the last episode and this one. I had a wedding in the family, and then my body got run down, and I got sick for quite some time, but here I am, back on the mend, and back on track. So anyways, last episode, we discussed Narvaez's expedition to Florida and the epic tale of Cabeza de Vaca and his three companions' survival through 8 years of wandering, privation, and enslavement. Well, when Cabeza de Vaca returned to New Spain, he told over his story to anyone who would listen, and he in fact wrote an account of it to Emperor Charles V in 1542. Rather counterintuitively, de Vaca's account of his difficulties and adventures excited rather than dampened the enthusiasm of the Spaniards for further undertakings in Florida and the wider North American continent. In this episode, we'll discuss another of those expeditions, undertaken by Hernando de Soto in 1539. De Soto was, ultimately, to fare little better than his predecessors had in Florida. But of course, in his hubris, he believed that he would succeed where everybody else had failed. Hernando de Soto was born to solid Hidalgo stock near Badajoz around 1500. As a tempestuous teen of about 15 years of age, he decided to try his fortunes in the New World and in 1514 set sail for the New World with Pedro Arias Davila, the newly appointed governor of Panama. Davila had set his eyes on the young Hernando several years before, seeing promise in the bright boy and paying for his tuition at the university in Salamanca. Now, however, Davila was going somewhere where books mattered little, and he brought young Hernando with him. Hernando de Soto served under Davila in his subsequent bloody campaigns against the natives in Nicaragua and Panama, and there earned distinction as a fighter of note, although his reputation was marred by a level of callous cruelty towards the natives remarkable even for his time and station. De Soto climbed his way up the social ladder of the rough-and-tumble society of the conquistadors, further developing his reputation as a fierce fighter, especially skilled at cowing, extorting, and enslaving hostile Indian tribes. Following the Spanish victory in the area, De Soto also received an encomienda in public office, which provided him with a source of income. De Soto continued in this manner until the death of his benefactor, Pedro Arias Davila, in 1531. Pedro Arias' death, combined with the failure of an expedition De Soto had financed to search for a strait to the Pacific, compelled De Soto to sell off his assets in Nicaragua and gamble it all by joining an expedition about to set out for Peru, led by Francisco Pizarro and Diego Almagro. We don't need to get into the details of the conquest of the Incan Empire, but suffice it to say that the conquest was a feat on par with Cortes' conquest of Mexico. In some respects, this conquest of Pizarro's actually outshone that of Cortes, particularly if we factor in the amount of gold and treasure the conquistadors obtained. De Soto distinguished himself throughout the campaign, and when he returned to Spain in 1536, he was a wealthy and respected man. He married the daughter of his late benefactor, Pedro Arias Davila, a formidable woman in her own right by the name of Isabella, or Inés de Bobadilla. He was also given leave to join the prestigious chivalric order of Santiago. In short, Hernando de Soto had a choice before him. He could retire now to Spain and live out the rest of his life in prosperity with his wife, or he could return to the New World to try his luck even further. Predictably, perhaps, de Soto chose the latter option. De Soto's original intention was to apply to the emperor for the governorship of what is now Ecuador and Colombia, which was then relatively untouched by the Spaniards, where he hoped to carve out his own fief, buttressed by Indian labor, much as Cortes had accomplished in Mexico. The emperor, however, had other plans. He had at best only heard rumors of Cabeza de Vaca's tale of survival, but the emperor did not have to hear all the gory details to know that Narvaez had failed miserably at his task of pacifying and colonizing Florida. The emperor was sick and tired of these bungling expeditions and pathetic failures. Here, standing before him, was a man who had time and time again displayed his worth as an Indian fighter. Just the sort of man who would be able to get the difficult job of pacifying the northern mainland done. The emperor, therefore, refused De Soto's request and instead made the eager conquistador a counter-offer. He would grant De Soto the immediate governorship of Cuba if he would only raise a force 500 strong and fund them for a term of at least 18 months. During this time, he was to endeavor to the utmost to conquer Florida for the crown of Spain. Should he succeed, he would be granted the governorship of whichever 600 miles of the coast he would so choose, as well as a reward of 2,000 ducats annually for the rest of his life, to be derived from the revenues created by the new province. Although De Soto would have to fund the expedition entirely on his own, he would nonetheless be allowed to retain the governorship of Cuba, provided that he faithfully abided by the terms set out in his charter. If, however, De Soto abjured his end of the treaty, he could be charged in Spain with high treason. All in all, the deal was a bit of a mixed bag for De Soto. He would have to swallow all of the expenses of what promised to be an extremely expensive campaign. He would have to risk all that he had, including life and limb, to wage war against the fierce natives of Florida for a full year and a half before he could even try to pull out. He was trapped into his end of the deal by the specter of prosecution for high treason, which almost invariably carried the death penalty. Still, De Soto took up the royal offer, as the potential rewards which would accrue to him in the case of success were quite large. Besides, it wasn't like the emperor would just offer him another position so fast if he turned down the offer currently held out by his Caesarian majesty. So, Hernando de Soto bit the bullet and took up the offer. Fortunately for de Soto, recruitment wasn't too much of an issue for him. He had returned from Peru with a whole gaggle of youthful followers who looked up to him as a great fighter and leader, as a role model whom they would happily serve under. Prominent among these followers was one Luis de Moscoso Alvarado, the nephew of Cortes's headstrong officer and hero of the Mexican campaign, Pedro de Alvarado. Moscoso was actually a relatively important fellow in De Soto's expedition, as he would actually come to lead the expedition following De Soto's death. But anyways, in the here and now, Moscoso and many others of this group were delighted to follow De Soto on another campaign, and they eagerly signed on for the year and a half of Floridian campaigning. Moscoso and the others were joined by swarms of bored yet martial noble youths, eager to grab their chance to go on what promised to be a glorious adventure in the New World. A number of these youths came from Elvas, Portugal, and it is from an unknown member of this group that we have our most thorough and most reliable account of the expedition. But we'll talk a little bit more about our sources in a moment. Meanwhile, the excitement surrounding Hernando de Soto's upcoming expedition was raised to an even higher pitch with the return to Spain of Cabeza de Vaca, the hardy survivor of the Narvaez expedition. As we've previously mentioned, Cabeza de Vaca's stories, which largely focused on the difficulty and poverty of the land, somehow managed to counterintuitively encourage further Spanish interest in Florida, rather than reduce it. Now, this is really strange. I'm sure we can all agree on that. Why on earth would the Spanish be more interested in Florida after hearing that it was a poor land with fierce natives? Well, we can begin to piece together the answer with a passage that turns up in the account we have of the Gentleman of Elvas, or to use the more precise term you'll hear bandied about by historians, the Fidalgo of Elvas. Fidalgo is the Portuguese word for the Spanish Hidalgo, which both mean gentleman or member of the lesser nobility. In any event, the Fidalgo writes that although when de Vaca returned, he persistently maintained that the land was poor, he also kept on saying that he had taken an oath along with his companion Dorantes not to reveal what the pair of them had seen, with the implication being that they had somewhere, somehow, found fabulous riches in the course of their sojourns. Now, of course, knowing what we know now about the southern United States at the time, we can entirely discount the possibility that Cabeza de Vaca and his friends actually discovered anything more than a few dusty villages which may have had a few golden trinkets. Definitely not anything that warranted them taking an oath of secrecy about. In light of this knowledge, we can interpret this coyness of Cabeza de Vaca in one of three different ways. A. It never happened, and the whole business about an oath was simply a rumor swirling around Spain at about the same time that the De Soto expedition was getting ready to set out. B. Cabeza de Vaca did in fact make an oath of some sort to Dorantes, maybe that they wouldn't reveal some of the things that happened to them or some of the things which they had done in order to survive, and that oath somehow turned into a pledge in which Cabeza de Vaca didn't want to talk about the riches they had discovered. Or C, and this is the most provocative of the possibilities, maybe Cabeza de Vaca was just a faker. Remember, it was just himself and three companions who had survived the expedition. Maybe the men had an agreement among themselves that they would agree upon a certain embellished set of events. We know from Coronado's later expedition that Estebanico, Dorantes' slave, was definitely not innocent of embellishing his tales unduly. If this third scenario is in fact true, and that is admittedly a big if, the effect it would have on our assumption that Cabeza de Vaca's account of his wanderings is trustworthy would be massive. In any event, putting our musings aside, Cabeza de Vaca was back, and for whatever reason, his arrival and his account excited a great many adventurous Spaniards to join De Soto's expedition. De Soto even made Cabeza de Vaca himself a generous offer to persuade him to join the expedition as a high-ranking officer. But no matter what was offered to him, Cabeza de Vaca refused. Some accounts have him initially accepting the offer and then later retracting his agreement on the grounds that he had no wish to be subordinate to another in a land he knew much better than anyone else. But with or without Cabeza de Vaca's participation, the expedition was ready to depart by April 1538. On the 6th of that month, the expedition set sail, comprising 10 ships and some 650 men, mostly soldiers, but also including several priests, monks, royal officials, and of course, sailors. So now, before we continue with the story of the expedition, let's talk for a moment about our sources. We have four primary sources of information about the De Soto expedition. The first, as well as the most extensive and most reliable of our sources, is the account of the Fidalgo of Elvas. The authenticity of this account shines through by way of its almost clinical analysis of the expedition and its fate. Most of the literature of the time regarding the conquests and such are chock full of dramatic speeches and heroic actions, as the authors generally tried to emulate the bombastic styles of Homer and the medieval romances, regardless of the compromised authenticity of the ensuing account. The Fidalgo eschews that sort of drama commonly found in contemporary histories. His is a sober account. In the words of one professor, Elvas's report, a lengthy one, is a somewhat peculiar document. It contains little of the sort of specific information that would suggest constant reference to a diary, yet it does not draw its bulk from the imaginative embroidery that is so often a characteristic of recollections without such a mooring. Absent, too, is the dramatic framework so common to conquest literature over the centuries. His main concern is getting the expedition from one place to another. Observations, asides, judgments, these play a distinctly secondary role, and the man himself, with a single exception, disappears behind the events. Whatever the reason for writing the report, and this remains a mystery, self-justification may be ruled out. End quote. The only flaw with the Fidalgo's account is that he was apparently a tremendous fan of De Soto's, and one notices a fairly persistent tendency throughout his writings to whitewash De Soto and the Spaniard's conduct far more than the other three sources we have in front of us. So, very often the other accounts will detail atrocities which the Spanish committed, and then along comes the Fidalgo and tells us that no, really, they got the story backwards, and in reality it was the Indians who were at fault for what happened, and the Spanish were just these noble people defending themselves. But anyways, the Fidalgo's account is an extremely reliable account. The next most reliable report, albeit a far less comprehensive one, is that of Luis Hernandez de Biedma, the emperor's agent who accompanied the expedition to Florida. De Biedma's place in the De Soto expedition was comparable to Cabeza de Vaca's place in the expedition of Pánfilo de Narváez. In any event, De Biedma left us the relation of the expedition which he sent to the emperor in 1544. As I've mentioned, the report is an entirely accurate one. We have no reason whatsoever to presume any bias or dishonesty on the agent's part. Of course, there are the usual flaws of, you know, human memory and so on, forgetfulness, but besides for that, the account is a reliable one. However, the one flaw with the account is its brevity. De Biedma's language is extremely terse, even laconic at times, and this stinginess with words costs his account a great deal in the way of detail. The next source we have, the third source, is the diary of Rodrigo Rangel, Hernando de Soto's private secretary. This diary is highly detailed and fairly reliable, but it is very clearly written with a mind towards self-promotion and as such suffers with regards to reliability. Rangel is always in the thick of things, always the hero, always saving the day, so there's that problem with his account. Another problem with his account is that it ends in the middle of the expedition with Hernando de Soto's death, and for some unknown reason doesn't actually continue to the end. Perhaps, following de Soto's death, Rangel no longer saw any immediate prospect for personal gain through his manuscript, and as such short-sightedly terminated his work, but we'll never know for sure. And the final problem with Rangel's account is that we don't actually have his original manuscript. We only have Rangel's account because de Oviedo, the historian who we mentioned back when we were discussing Ponce de Leon, incorporated it into his history. Oviedo also adds his own little editorial in there, so we really only have an edited version of Rangel's account extant. So these three sources are all fairly accurate, and we're kind of quibbling when we rank them in order of usefulness and trustworthiness. But the fourth and most popular source we have for De Soto's expedition clears the charts insofar as incredulity is concerned. That source, of course, is Garcilaso de la Vega's curiously named book, The Florida of the Inca, which we quoted at some length last episode when we discussed the captivity of Juan Ortiz. As I'm sure you've gathered from that reading, Garcilaso de la Vega's account is quite a dramatic one, replete with invented speeches, exaggerated details, and so on. This is in a large part due to the fact that de la Vega wasn't actually present at the expedition and instead based his entire account off of interviews which he held with several survivors of the expedition. Of course, these sorts of interviews tend to produce some fairly distorted stories, filtered as they are through the lenses of ego and forgetfulness. Still, in many respects, such as with regards to the many details of Juan Ortiz's story, Garcilaso's account is corroborated by the other three accounts of the expedition, and his history has remained tremendously popular, although it might be said that this is because of its inaccuracies, not in spite of them. Okay, so now that we've given you the basic rundown of the primary sources which we'll be utilizing, we can now get on to the actual story. So, as we've mentioned earlier, De Soto's expedition departed Spain for the Indies on April 7, 1539. After 15 days at sea, the fleet stopped in the Canaries to resupply, and from there they moved on to Cuba. De Soto had learned from Narvaez's mistakes, and so he sent one of his captains ahead of him twice to scout out the coast of Florida and search for a suitable harbor for the fleet. He also recruited a local Havana magnate and encomendero named Vasco Porcayo de Figueroa to join his expedition, which he subsequently supplied with a great deal of money with which to stock up on provisions. On May 18th, having left his wife Isabella in the care of a friend, Hernando de Soto sailed out of Havana, northward bound to Florida and his destiny. Garcilaso de la Vega puts the size of the Spanish force which came to Florida, together with de Soto, at 1,000 men and 350 horses. A more accurate figure would probably be Rangel's total of 570 soldiers, 130 sailors and slaves, and about 250 horses, several dozen of which died at sea. After a relatively uneventful journey, the expedition made landfall in Tampa Bay. The first village which the Spaniards discovered was the village of Hirahigua, where the unfortunate Juan Ortiz had been held for his first year and a half of captivity. The village was largely deserted, but the Spaniards captured several Indians who told them of a Christian living nearby. This was, of course, Juan Ortiz. The Spanish sent out several scouting expeditions to explore the surrounding region. One of these parties came across Juan Ortiz, whom they were about to kill, presuming him to be just another Indian, when he managed to cry out haltingly, "Sevilla, Sevilla," indicating to the Spaniards that he was a native of Seville. With Ortiz, the Spanish obtained a valuable interpreter to assist them in communicating with the natives, much as Aguilar was of service to Cortes 20 years earlier. Another of the Spanish scouting parties was ambushed, in the first instance of what would become a depressing pattern for the expedition. The Indians would move quickly, fire a few well-aimed arrows at the Spaniards, and then disappear back into the thick brush before the Spaniards could react. Oviedo renders this first incident thus. That same day, Captain Johan Ruiz Lobillo went up into the country with about 40 foot soldiers and came upon some huts, but were able to take only two Indian women. To rescue them, 9 Indians followed him, shooting at him for 3 leagues, and they slew 1 Christian and wounded 3 or 4, yet without his being able to do them any harm, although he had arquebusiers and crossbowmen, because these Indians were as agile and as good fighters as can be found among all the nations of the world. The Fidalgo of Elvas gives us slightly more details regarding this Indian mode of warfare. The Indians are exceedingly ready with their weapons, and so warlike and nimble that they have no fear of footmen, for if these charge them, they flee, and when they turn their backs, they are presently upon them. They avoid nothing more easily than the flight of an arrow. They never remain quiet, but are continually running, traversing from place to place, so that neither crossbow nor arquebus can be aimed at them. Before a Christian can make a single shot with either, an Indian will discharge 3 or 4 arrows, and he seldom misses of his object. Where the arrow meets with no armor, it pierces as deeply as a shaft from a crossbow. Their bows are very perfect. The arrows are made of certain canes, like reeds, very heavy and so stiff that one of them, when sharpened, will pass through a target. Some are pointed with the bone of a fish, sharpened like a chisel, others with some stone, like a point of diamond. Of such, the greater number, when they strike upon armor, break at the place the parts are put together. Those of cane split, and will enter a shirt of mail, doing more injury than when armed. De Soto, who had already developed a reputation in his early career as a bloodthirsty man who enjoyed torturing and killing Indians for sport, obviously did not react well to the Indians' resistance, and he would come to wage a brutal and savage war against virtually all of the Indians he would encounter. Even many, though by no means all of those Indians who had shown the Spaniards kindness and hospitality. It was almost routine for the Spaniards to cast some Indian who had committed some negligible offense to the fierce dogs they brought along with them, to be torn apart, and eaten alive. Mass murders occurred frequently over the course of the expedition, and although we're not going to give a tedious blow-by-blow account of every skirmish and atrocity that occurred over the course of the campaign, I suppose you'll trust me when I say that De Soto surpassed the great majority of his peers in wanton cruelty and disregard for human life. In any event, shortly following Ortiz's rescue, the Spaniards moved on to Mocoso, the village where Juan Ortiz was so hospitably welcomed 9 years before. In Mocoso, the Spaniards were well received as their compatriot had been in the past, but as usual, the Spaniards began to overstay their welcome. The chief got the Spanish to leave by the only way which he was able, by telling them that the gold and riches they sought were farther to the north, at a village called Paracoji, and they would need to travel that way. It was a simple trick, but time and time again, Indian chiefs would use it to great effect on the greedy Spaniards. They would just inform their rapacious guests that the treasure they sought was but a few days away, after which the Spaniards would arrive at another village where the same trick would be repeated. Throughout the summer and autumn of 1539, the Spanish continued their northward trek through Florida, fighting, pillaging, kidnapping, and seizing the local chiefs as captives and the local women to satisfy their lusts. On one notable occasion, at the Indian village of Calinquin, De Soto took the chief and his daughter hostage to serve as their guards. The Indians, seeking to rescue their chief, surrounded the Spaniards with bowmen and were preparing to launch an all-out assault against the Spaniards to release their captive compatriots. The Indian attack, however, was thwarted by Luis Moscoso de Alvarado, the young nephew of Cortes's Alvarado who had joined up with De Soto while down in Peru. Moscoso, seeing what the Indians were up to, spurred his horse and charged out into them while calling out for the others to join him. This they did, and the unexpected, preemptive strike threw the Indians into disarray. Despite this disruption to their battle plan, Rangel tells us that the Indians still fought hard in the face of the Spanish onslaught. However, once the Indians lost the initiative, it was clear that they were doomed. Eventually, the Indians broke, leaving some 30 to 40 dead behind them. The broken Indians, having no other way to escape the swift Spanish cavalry, took refuge in two large ponds of water, hoping to thus neutralize the devastating advantage the horses conferred upon the Spaniards. The problem, however, was that even though the Indians had escaped the Spanish horses, they were now trapped in the ponds. Throughout the day, the Spaniards fired at the swimming Indians with their crossbows, and when night fell, they surrounded one of the ponds with soldiers to prevent the Indians from escaping. They would have surrounded both ponds, but the Spanish didn't have enough men to do so, so they allowed the Indians in the second pond to escape under cover of darkness. The trapped Indians in the second pond, however, were not as lucky. All through the night, they either silently slipped beneath the dark surface, never to rise again, or, pushed to their very limits of endurance, staggered half-dead out of the ponds and into Spanish captivity, after potentially over 12 hours of treading water. Over 300 Indians were captured in this manner. When morning rose, the Spaniards expected to see a placid and undisturbed surface where the multitude of Indians had been the evening before. They were shocked, however, to see 12 resolute Indians, too proud to surrender, continuing to tread water, defiantly declaring that they would die before giving themselves up to the Spaniards. De Soto had some of his native auxiliaries dive into the pond and pull out the unwilling warriors, which they did by dragging out the nearly dead braves by their hair. De Soto, who couldn't have failed but to be impressed by the fortitude of these stalwart Indians, had them bound and brought to a tent, where he began to commend them for their perseverance and tell them that he would like them as friends. De Soto began to have them untied until one of the defiant chiefs, his hands recently unbound, wound up and punched De Soto in the mouth, knocking out two of his teeth. De Soto, enraged by these unyielding Indians, had all the chiefs and the vast majority of those who had surrendered the night before in the ponds bound to stakes and there shot to death with arrows. In any event, as winter set in, somewhere about the end of October 1539, the Spaniards arrived in Appalachia, where they were distraught to find Narvaez's final shipbuilding site. They saw the bones of the horses which the Spaniards had eaten and saw all around them signs of the privations and struggle which their compatriots were forced to undergo in their final days. With their morale already plummeting, the Spaniards also learned what their unfortunate countrymen had over a decade before, that there was no easy way through Appalachia. It was all marsh and swamp and quicksand, desolate, barren, and swarming with hostile Indians. The Spanish spent a miserable winter in Appalachia, fighting a grueling campaign against the Appalachian Indians, who, as we've previously mentioned, were masters of hit-and-run warfare. Many Spaniards were killed in these attacks, and the Spanish attempts to terrorize the Indians into submission invariably ended in failure. They would mutilate and dismember, torture and kill, but the Appalachian Indians would never back down. Rangel was apparently very impressed by the natives of Appalachia, writing, "Although the Spaniards pursued them and burned them, they were never willing to make peace. If their hands and noses were cut off, they made no account of it. Then, as if each of them had been a Mucius Scaevola of Rome. Not one of them, for fear of death, denied that he belonged to Appalachia. And when they were taken and asked from whence they were, they replied proudly, 'From whence am I from? I am an Indian of Appalachia.' And they gave one to understand that they would be insulted if they were to be thought of as any other tribe than the Appalachians." During this winter, De Soto sent his ships out westward to search for another harbor ahead on the trail, and they returned with news of a deep and well-protected harbor some 60 leagues away from Appalachia, Pensacola Bay, in a prosperous province they called Ochusa. De Soto then dispatched his ships back to Havana with orders to buy more provisions for the expedition and to be at Pensacola by the summer, where De Soto and his forces would meet up with them. Should De Soto not reach Ochusa and this bay by the summer, the fleet was to return to Cuba and come back the next year. His captains would keep their end of the plan. De Soto, foolishly, would not keep his. You see, an Indian captive declared that he had heard that somewhere to the northeast reigned a fabulously wealthy queen who collected tribute from all of her neighbors. If De Soto would wish to investigate these claims, he would need to travel to the northeast rather than to the west. In March, De Soto and his men continued their march northwards, struggling to ford several fairly powerful rivers. Once they had succeeded in doing so, however, with minimal losses, the conditions around them markedly improved. Food was generally more abundant, and although there were rough spots, the terrain was far better than what they had been slogging through farther to the south. Throughout March and April, they marched clear through Georgia, from the Florida Panhandle to South Carolina, arriving at numerous villages along the way, most of whom offered the Spaniards food and guided them to the next village. At the end of April 1540, the Spanish finally found the queen of whom the Indian captive spoke, at Cofitachecui, a paramount chiefdom based out of what is now Camden, South Carolina. Cofitachecui rule was spread out over several thousand square miles of South Carolina, and the queen welcomed De Soto with the gift of a string of pearls, which he placed around his neck. Over the next several weeks, the Spanish, to their delight, found a tremendous abundance of pearls, according to Rangel, some 200 pounds, in an Indian tomb. The Spanish also made another curious discovery, Basque-made iron axes, salvaged by the Indians from the nearby site of Lucas Vázquez de Ayllón's failed colony of San Miguel de Guadalupe. In May, the Spanish departed from Cofitachecui, laden with pearls, though not before treacherously kidnapping the queen and all of her handmaidens to serve as hostages and guides. This duplicity infuriates De Oviedo, and at this point in his history, he goes off on a wild rant against De Soto and the men of his ilk, part of which we'll quote right here. Eventually, the queen managed to escape, but this was a most disgraceful act of ingratitude on Di Soto's part. Oviedo, here in his history, pauses to castigate Di Soto and his men's avarice and faithlessness. O wicked men! O devilish greed! O bad consciences! O unfortunate soldiers! That ye should not have understood the perils ye were to encounter, and how wasted would be your lives, and without rest your souls! That ye were not mindful of that truth, which the blessed Saint Augustine uttered in lamenting the miseries of this life, saying, "This life is a life of misery, frail and uncertain, full of toil and stain, a life, Lord, of ills, a kingdom of pride, full of miseries and terror, since it is not really life, nor can be called so, but rather death, for in a moment it is ended by various changes of fortune and diverse kinds of deaths." Give ear then, Catholic reader, and do not lament the conquered Indians less than their Christian conquerors or slayers of themselves, as well as others, and follow the adventures of this governor, ill-governed, taught in the school of Pedrarias de Avila, in the scattering and wasting of the Indians of Castilla del Oro, a graduate in the killing of the natives of Nicaragua and canonized in Peru as a member of the Order of the Pizarros. And then, after being delivered from all those paths of hell and having come to Spain loaded with gold, neither bachelor nor married, knew not how nor was able to rest without returning to the Indies to shed human blood, not content with what he had spilled already, and to leave life as shall be narrated, and providing the opportunity for so many sinners deluded with his vain words to perish after him. End quote. From Cofitachequi, the Spanish turned northwest, recrossing the Appalachians and marching through North Carolina and Tennessee, before turning southwards again back into Georgia, into the territory of the Coosa Confederation. The Coosa were by far the most powerful confederation in the American Southeast at the time, and they ruled over a large swath of Georgia, Alabama, and Tennessee, over an area containing upwards of 50,000 Indians. Here too, De Soto, without any provocation, seized and shackled the chief and principal men of Coosa, forcing them to guide the Spaniards along their blood-stained journey. But the Spaniards were about to get their comeuppance in a big way, when they took hostage the chief of Tuscaloosa in northern Alabama. The chief, a giant and forbidding man, went along with the Spaniards, but this time the conquistadors were not dealing with a pushover. The chief of Tuscaloosa was enraged that the Spaniards should presume to take him prisoner, and so he led them straight into the gaping maw of disaster. On October 18th, 1540, the Spaniards with their prisoners and all their supplies entered Mabila, a stockade belonging to the Tuscaloosa. It soon became clear, however, that they had walked into a trap. An altercation soon broke out between the Spaniards and the people of Mabila, who were all young Tuscaloosan braves armed to the teeth and spoiling for a fight. Suspicious of a rising chant outside of his hut, De Soto asked an Indian what was going on. When the Indian contemptuously ignored him, one of the Spanish captains grabbed him by the arm and was in turn given a shove by the defiant Indian. The captain drew his sword and slashed at the Indian, when all hell broke loose. Indians on all sides, everywhere, popped out of their hiding places and began to fire their arrows at the surprised Spanish. De Soto, recognizing the gravity of his situation, realized that he and his men had to get out of the enclosure as soon as possible. The Spanish shoved and hacked their way out of the stockade, while behind them the Indians swung the gates shut and barricaded them, separating the Spaniards from all their supplies. De Soto had no choice but to order the storming of the town. The Spanish charged at the town repeatedly, but the Indians were too well entrenched, and several times the Spanish were forced back. The Fidalgo relates how the dismounted Spaniards would battle fiercely to enter the city, only to be repulsed repeatedly, stopping only to drink from the fresh water, which was by now discolored by the blood of the slain. The Spanish, unable to take the town by storm, resorted instead to burning it to the ground. The Spanish, forcing their way up to 3 out of the 4 walls of the stockade, lit them ablaze, keeping the fire going as it raced through the Indian city. The wooden buildings of Mabila became a furnace, a pyre for the braves who had refused to submit to the Spanish depredations. The Indians fought bravely. There was no surrender offered nor received. By the end of the day, some 2,500 to 3,000 Indians were dead, victims to either the fire or the sword, while some 20 Spaniards lay dead and over 100 seriously wounded. Among the dead were several men of high rank, including De Soto's own nephew. In addition, the fire which had consumed Mabila had destroyed the Spanish supplies as well. The expedition was left with literally nothing, not spare clothes, not spare weapons, and worst of all to De Soto, none of the pearls from the queen he had so mistreated. All gone, burnt as an offering on the altar of his own cruelty. The men were quite demoralized by this disaster, and many of them lobbied to head down to Pensacola Bay, which was just some 6 days' march south, and meet up with their ships. They had so far encountered nothing but hardship and toil, and now, after all that suffering, they were left with nothing. They wanted out. De Soto, however, refused. He currently had absolutely nothing to show for 2 years of labor and over 100 dead Spaniards, and he refused to give up just yet. So instead of heading to the south, the expedition headed west, through Alabama and into Mississippi. They spent the winter of 1540-1541 in Mississippi, in the territory of the Chickasaw Indians. The winter was a bitterly cold one, and the Spaniards suffered tremendously from their lack of supplies. The Chickasaw, however, supplied them with the food they needed to survive the winter. Grudgingly, perhaps, but there it was nonetheless. By the end of the winter, however, the Chickasaw had grown sick and tired of the Spaniards, for whatever inexplicable reason, and they had resolved to wipe the Spanish out through a nighttime surprise attack. On the night of the 4th of March, 1541, at about 4 o'clock in the morning, 4 columns of Chickasaws crept up to where the Spanish were sleeping, coming from each of the 4 sides. They were spotted way too late by the Spanish sentries, and the moment they were spotted, they gave a deafening roar, pounded on their drums, and rushed forward and set the Spanish quarters aflame. Everywhere, the Spaniards were running around in a panic, choked by the smoke, blinded by the flames, and disoriented by the cacophonous Indian din. As the Indians poured their arrows into the masses, the Spaniards desperately tried to find their weapons, their equipment, and their clothing. Virtually all of the horses were burnt alive in their stalls, their shrieking whinnies only adding to the hellish confusion. 12 Spaniards perished that night in the flames. One of the most tragic Spanish deaths of the expedition was that of the poor Francisca de Ginestrosa, wife of one of the soldiers. Francisca, who was 8 or 9 months pregnant, had managed to escape the burning building, but had returned to get her pearls. She thought she would have time to get out, but the flames were faster than she had thought, and when she tried to exit, she found that she was trapped in the house. She shrieked and she cried for her husband to come and save her, but he was fighting the Indians at the time and was unable to help her. She and her baby were consumed in the conflagration, presumably along with the pearls she so desired. The Spanish scattered all over. Had the Indians properly followed up on this strike of theirs, they could have utterly wiped out the Spanish force. However, they failed to follow up on their victory, and the Spanish were able to regroup, although they were still quite battered up. This time, the Spanish had really lost it all. Virtually all of the horses were dead, most of the men had no weapons or armor, and some of them were actually naked. Not a pleasant thing at any time, let alone in early March. However, like we've said, the Indians never really capitalized on their victory, and within a week the Spanish had refashioned most of their missing equipment, which was a good thing for them because on the 15th of March, the Chickasaw attacked them again in force. The Spanish fought hard, and although they took a few casualties, by and by large, they deflected the wrath of the Indians. Soon the Spanish moved on, heading further to the northwest. In late May, the group first lay eyes on the Great Mississippi River just south of Memphis, and 1 month later, became the first Europeans to cross it. Over the rest of the winter of 1541-1542, the group continued to wander about aimlessly through Arkansas and Louisiana. Over the course of the winter, their treasured interpreter, Juan Ortiz, succumbed to disease, which is actually pretty sad. Ortiz had survived a decade of Hirahigua's wrath and hatred, only to die in the end for a fellow Spaniard's vanity, greed, and stubbornness. As it turned out, the end was near for that fellow Spaniard as well. In the spring of 1542, De Soto's men finally prevailed on him to turn back eastward and head back to the Mississippi River, by way of which they would be able to send out attempts to return to civilization. The recognition that he had, like his predecessors, failed so spectacularly at his task, shattered De Soto, and he soon fell ill with a fever. The embittered De Soto, who realized he was dying, designated Moscoso as his successor and enjoined him to return the men to civilization. And then, on May 21st, 1542, Hernando De Soto died somewhere in Louisiana, a victim of his own insatiable greed. In the end, he fared exactly like all those who had preceded him to Florida. Ponce de Leon, Aylon, Narvaez, none of these men emerged alive from the crucible of their own ambition and folly. Moscoso had De Soto secretly buried in the waters of the Mississippi, so that the natives wouldn't find out that the immortal leader of the white men had died, and after this, Moscoso immediately got to work getting the surviving men back to civilization. It was first decided to go back westward and to try to march to Panuco, as Cabeza de Vaca and his friends had done. From June through October 1542, the Spaniards wandered westward through Louisiana and into eastern Texas. Food was scarce, deaths were mounting, and there was not a shred of optimism in the entire group. Finally, in October, the men decided that the land they were in was way too poor to sustain them over the coming winter, and so they decided to return to the Mississippi again. Just think about the route they had taken. They marched up the coast of Florida, and then, instead of rendezvousing with their ships at Pensacola, a relatively short distance to their west, they decided instead to seek out the riches they had heard existed to the northeast. They traveled all the way to the coast of South Carolina before looping around into Tennessee and back south into Georgia and Alabama, where they were roughly treated in Mobile. From there, they went west into Mississippi and to the northwest into Louisiana and Arkansas. From Arkansas, they wheeled back around to the Tennessee-Louisiana border, where De Soto died. Under Moscoso, they had first elected to march westward to Panuco, but after traipsing through Louisiana and part of Texas, they gave that up and were now returning to the Mississippi again. The Spanish were just wandering in circles, all the while suffering from hunger, thirst, exposure, and Indian attacks. By the end of December, the Spanish had made it back to the Mississippi, having had to battle with hostile Indians and root about desperately for food, as the natives had by now learned to keep their food supplies well hidden. Throughout the winter, the Spanish worked on building ships, a course of action which frightened many who remembered the bitter fate of Narvaez's expedition. In truth, however, the current expedition was much more prepared for shipbuilding than was Narvaez's expedition, as they had with them a number of Basque and Portuguese carpenters and a Genoese shipbuilder who knew exactly what to do to improvise a fairly decent ship. As the Spaniards were building the ships, they were supplied with food by one of the local friendly tribes, but they were also visited frequently by other tribes, whom the Spaniards trusted considerably less. Moscoso was suspicious of the Indians' designs, and on one occasion he ordered that one of the Indians be secretly abducted and held until his compatriots had departed. When the Indians departed, Moscoso had his prisoner tortured, until he spilled the beans and told the Spanish that a confederation of some 20 villages was preparing to attack them. 3 days before the attack, the Indians would send the Spanish a gift of smoked fish in order to lull them into a false sense of security. They would do the same again on the day of the assault, except that then some Indians would sneak into the Spanish armory and steal their weapons. The Spanish kept the man prisoner, and sure enough, along came a party of Indians from the villages the man had mentioned, bearing a gift of smoked fish for the Spanish. Moscoso immediately had them seized and had their right hands cut off, sending them back to their chief with the message that he knew every thought which entered their minds before they even said it. The Indians were terrified, and they came groveling to the Spaniards and making excuses, and after making a few more punitive examples out of the Indians, the Spaniards were once again safe. Finally, in June 1543, the boats were completed. 7 brigantines, not all that strong, but still far more seaworthy than those of Narvaez, were launched onto the Mississippi, along with a number of large canoes which were tied along behind them. The Spanish killed all but the finest of their horses and cured the meat, stocking up for the upcoming voyage at sea. On July 2, 1543, the Spaniards embarked on their ships and began their voyage back to civilization, leaving behind them some 500 weeping and distraught natives. These were the Indians who had joined the Spaniards over the years, in many cases converted to Christianity, and who now spoke Spanish. Many of them were hundreds and hundreds of miles away from their homeland, and now that the Spaniards had abandoned them, they were simply adrift in a strange land with no way to return to their previous lives. No wonder they cried. As the Spaniards floated downstream, they were beset by swarms of Indians who chased them, fired arrows at them, and even managed to overturn one canoe and drown the 12 Spaniards aboard in full sight of their horrified companions. The Indians continued their pursuit all the way until the Spaniards sailed past the mouth of the Mississippi and into the Gulf of Mexico. The Spaniards, who had no knowledge whatsoever of navigation, determined that the wisest course of action would be for them to hug the coast until they reached Panuco and not to risk sailing out into the open sea. But sailing along the coast had its perils as well, and several gales buffeted the crafts so dangerously close to the coast that they were in immediate danger of being shattered on the coastline. Precisely the sort of catastrophe which spelled the doom of Narvaez's expedition. On 2 occasions, all hands jumped off of the ships and literally pushed the ships away from the coastline with their bare hands, struggling for hours on end against the powerful winds and currents. The men were also attacked by swarms of mosquitoes so thick that they blackened the scales, and the men were bitten so many times that their faces swelled up to monstrous proportions. But still, these men had better fortune than Narvaez's, and on September 10, 1543, 53 days after departing down the Mississippi and over 4 years after having left Havana, Moscoso and most of his men safely arrived in Panuco. The first thing they did upon landing was to go to the local church to offer thanksgiving, after which they were graciously received, fed, and clothed by the locals. The rest of Moscoso's men arrived in Panuco shortly thereafter. De Soto had departed Cuba over 4 years earlier with 600 men. Now only half that number remained. Still, considering what had befallen the other expeditions who had gone to Florida, De Soto's men could consider themselves lucky. In the end, though, they had made no money and accomplished no great deeds. Indeed, the only lasting legacy of the De Soto expedition was negative. Basically, the cumulative effect of the catastrophes which had befallen every Spanish expedition to visit Florida so far served to deter future adventurers from trying their luck in Florida. Oh, and they introduced pigs to the United States. That was their sole real accomplishment. They introduced pigs to the United States. Pretty soon, the euphoria of their survival wore off, and the men of the expedition began to grumble that they should have never quit America and should have instead built a colony there. Their disillusion soon ballooned into a rage, and that rage soon turned murderous. The men began to riot and actually kill one another, with each faction blaming the others for the misfortunes of the expedition. In the end, the men had to be separated from each other and separately conveyed to Mexico City, from where they each made their separate way onwards through life. Meanwhile, De Soto's captains had not given up on the search. They had obeyed his orders and had gone to Pensacola Bay in the summers of 1540 and 1541. When De Soto had not shown up, they began to search the entire Gulf Coast, everywhere leaving messages in bottles on the shore. They kept up their search for the next 2 years until they heard the tragic news at Veracruz. The captains returned with heavy hearts to Havana, where they informed Doña Isabel, who had for the past 3 years done nothing but wait for De Soto, that her beloved husband was never going to return to her again. Stricken with grief, she died shortly thereafter of a broken heart. Such were the fruits of Hernando de Soto's unbridled ambition.